Well, good morning, church. It's good to see you all this morning. I keep forgetting to get my mic, so excuse me while I put this on. But we have a couple of things to talk about before we get started this morning. I don't know about you all, but I'm feeling especially happy today. I don't really know why. There's been kind of a roller coaster of events that have happened over the last few weeks, but all of them have been for good. This last week, one of our dear sisters has gone home, and we're going to have our memorial service for her tomorrow. And that is a joyful thing to think about, remembering her life and that now she's with the Lord. And we're thankful for that. And on top of that, we have a new sister with us. For those of y'all that didn't see the email yesterday, what is today? Sunday. Today is Sunday. We meet on Sundays. I knew that. On Friday evening, Bailey Roberts was baptized into Christ for the forgiveness of her sins. And she's here this morning. And if you haven't got a chance to meet Bailey, she's sitting over there on my right side by Joe. So make sure that you go and talk to her. And we are so happy for that. In Luke chapter 15, after Jesus tells the story of the lost sheep and the 99 sheep and the one lost sheep, and the man goes out to get his one lost sheep and he finds him, and he's so joyful in that moment. In verse 7, he says, "Just so I tell you that there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over the 99 righteous persons who need no repentance." And so there's joy in heaven and there's joy here this morning, and rejoicing with that with Bailey. So we're really happy about that as well. And before we get started in our message this morning, I want to remind everyone. And now the PowerPoint is not working. Well, that's unfortunate. But this evening, we have a guest speaker coming with us, Chase Byers. I think that it's turning on, warming up. But Chase Byers is going to be here, and he's going to be speaking to us on a topic that he's titled God Rocks, and it's Living in a Museum of God's Faithfulness. And so we're going to be going through the book of Joshua at 5 p.m. and talking about the 8 different rock monuments that the Israelites set up and the memorials that those served for the Israelites, and then making applications for ourselves on the memorials that God has given us in our lives and how we can use those to better serve God. This morning, however, we're going to be in Psalm 137. Psalm 137. We referenced this psalm last week, and I want to spend some time this morning talking about it. It's an interesting little psalm, and it's only 9 verses, but it's packed full of really interesting information in this psalm. And I want to just start this morning by reading just the first 6 verses in this psalm, and then we'll talk about where we want to go with that this morning. So let's just read Psalm 137, starting in verse 6. It says, "By the waters of Babylon, there we sat down and wept, when we remembered Zion. On the willows there we hung up our lyres, for there our captors required of us songs, and our tormentors mirth, saying, Sing us one of the songs of Zion. How can we sing the Lord's songs in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its skill. Let my tongue stick to the roof of my mouth. If I do not remember you, if I do not set Jerusalem above my highest joy." This is an interesting psalm to think about, and we're going to break down this whole psalm. And what I want to do this morning is give kind of an overview of the psalm, so we're all on the same page going forward. And then we're just going to look at the psalm kind of in depth at each verse and what each phrase really means in the psalm and make some applications for ourselves. But this is a fascinating psalm that I think answers a lot of questions. But one question in particular that I think it answers is this idea of what do you do when you don't feel like singing? And not necessarily just singing songs in worship service, singing hymns, but just singing in general. Have you ever experienced something like that? Have you ever been so down or so depressed or so worn out or whatever that just the thought of music was just kind of abhorrent to you? You didn't want anything to do with music. I'm not a particularly musically inclined person, but I do enjoy music. I love listening to music, singing along with music, and for those of you that have rode in my car with me, you know that when the radio comes on, even if I don't know what the song is, I'll be singing along to the song. I like singing. And yet there are some times whenever things aren't going particularly well in my life and in the lives of others that music is just kind of out of the picture. We don't want to sing. We don't want to be comforted. We don't want any of that in our lives. And I think that that's one of the things that's addressed here in this psalm by the Israelites. When in verse 3, they said, "Our captors require of us songs, and our tormentors say, Sing us one of the songs of Zion." And they say, "How can we sing the Lord's songs?" That they just don't want to sing. They don't feel like singing in this situation. And so we're going to look at that this morning and what is going on in this psalm. But we're going to start with kind of an overview of the psalm here. The first thing that I want to bring to our attention whenever we're going through this psalm is we need to understand, and if you don't remember anything else about the psalm and its structure, remember this, that this psalm is written by some people who are in an utterly powerless situation. That they have no power, they have no control over their situation. And that's important for understanding the perspective that the psalm is coming from. These are the Jews who have been taken into Babylonian exile because that's what they'd earned for themselves. They decided they didn't want God, they decided they didn't want to follow God, and so God in his righteous judgment, he sent them into Babylon. He sent the Babylonians to take them into captivity. And they're stuck there for 70 years, and they can't do anything about that. And so they're coming from this position of weakness, this position of suffering. And as we move forward in this psalm, what we'll see, this psalm, it's short, but it's similar in structure. If you flip back a few pages in your psalms to Psalm 120, and then going through Psalm 120, if you look at just the top of the psalms and the titles of those psalms, Psalm 120 through Psalm 134, you see that they're titled the Songs of Ascents. And this psalm is not a song of ascent, but it's similar in size and in structure and placement through the rest of the psalms. It's short, but it has this powerful message as an exilic psalm. And now what that means, and we've already talked about this, it's just a fancy way of saying this psalm was written either during the time of the exile or maybe after the exile, but it's recalling this Babylonian time when they were sent into their land. And now whether or not this was written while they were actually in exile or not, it's very obvious as we get into this psalm that that's what they're referring to. It actually mentions Babylon as the location of where these events are happening. And this psalm is full of just misery and oppression. That's kind of weird, kind of unorthodox for most psalms. When you go to the psalms and you read in the psalms, what you expect is to find comfort or joy or some kind of peace. And that's true in a lot of the psalms. When you read those, even some of the lamentations that we read, these psalms particularly that David would write, where he is oppressed, where there's all this evil going on in his life, at least at the end of those psalms, there's almost always a resolution or this resolve at the end, where there's this idea that God has helped us up until this point and he will continue to help us. We don't really have that in this psalm. There is, in verse 5 and 6, there is a little bit of personal resolve, where there's this individual decision that this life may be hard, we may be going through all this persecution, but I'm going to keep on keeping on, as it were. And so we do have that little bit, but there's not really a lot of comfort in this psalm. And when we get to the end of the psalm, it seems like there's just downright vengeance in this psalm. And I think that we need to see it in context, and we'll talk about these verses, but here's a preview of what we're going to be getting to this morning. In verse 9, this is how the psalm ends. It says, "Blessed shall he be who takes your little ones, your children, and dashes them against the rock." Now that's not very comforting at all. That's not a comforting thought. How would you like it if we had this psalm in our hymnals? If this morning, for our invitation song, we sang this as one of our verses? There would be some people that might be a little uncomfortable with that. This isn't the type of song that we would teach to our children. But this is what the Israelites were singing. And I think that it's important to see the context, and it'll make more sense as we get through the structure of the psalm this morning. And so this morning, we're just going to read through the psalm, do a brief exposition of it, and see what each verse means. So we'll start in verses 1 and 2. Verse 1 and 2 says, "By the waters of Babylon, we sat down and wept. And we remembered Zion. And on the willows there, we hung up our lyres." In these opening verses, what we have is just kind of a picture of the resignation of the Israelites. They've just given up. They've just decided that this is no good. We can't respond in joy, and so we're going to respond in defeat. And so they set the stage of where all of this is happening. It's happening in Babylon, on the rivers of Babylon. And I think that that carries a lot of weight with it when you think about what that really means. These people, the Israelites, have been displaced, dislocated from their land. And that carries a lot more than just being moved to a different location. There were a lot of struggles and hardships that came with that for the Israelites. They were moving from Israel, from the Promised Land, from the land that God had given them that flowed with milk and honey, to the land of Babylon, which it says in the psalm is between the two rivers. Now, if you remember your geography, you remember that if you're looking, the Mediterranean Sea will be over on your right side, and you have Israel, and up here on the northeast, there was Babylon, and it was sitting in between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. that land, if you do a little geography research, that land is very dry, it's very arid, it's very flat, it's very desert-like. And while the Israelites would have had their fair share of arid type of climate to deal with, it would have been nothing compared to what it was like in Babylon. And so they're dislocated from a good land to a desert-type land. But on top of that, they're moved there away from Zion. It says they sat down and wept. And the reason why they wept is because we remembered Zion. Now, Zion, and when you're reading through in the Psalms, Zion is the city of God. And it's talked about the city as the city of God or the mountain of the Lord. It's this place that God dwells, where God had said, I'm going to put my name here. My people are going to be here. My temple is going to be here. And I'm going to dwell with my people in Zion. And it was a perfect kind of utopia to live in. And they remember that as being Jerusalem. Jerusalem is where God was dwelling. It's where God had set his temple. It's where they worshiped God. But now they're taken away from that. And so these people are taken away not only from their everyday life, but they're taken away from the spiritual center of their life. They no longer have the temple to offer sacrifices. They no longer have the priesthood, even if they did have the temple, to know who can offer the sacrifices and worship God. They can't participate in their yearly festivals that were commanded for them to do. They were completely separated from God in almost every single way. And if being dislocated from your homeland and from your spiritual center of life wasn't enough, what made it worse for the people of Israel is that their oppressors were there. It says in verse 2 that they were so distraught that they hung up their lyres. Now, lyres, when you read through the Psalms, lyres or harps are significant in the Psalms. They denote this praise or this worship to God, this joy that you have in worshiping God. And the Israelites are so defeated at this point that they're just standing there by the river, completely consumed with grief, and saying, we can't even play our harps anymore. We can't even play our lyres anymore. And they're just setting them down. And the reason why they do that comes in verse 3. In verse 3, it says, there our captors required of us songs, and our tormentors mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. And their response is, how can we sing the Lord's songs in a foreign land? These tormentors are coming out. And apparently, if you do a little bit of research into the Assyrian captivity, you remember the history, the Israelite nation was separated into two different nations, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, Israel and Judah. And Israel was taken into captivity first by the Assyrians. And King Sennacherib was part of doing that. And when you look in excavations that we found in King Sennacherib's palace, we found this relief, this bas-relief of the Assyrian army leading away Jewish captives, and they're holding their harps. They're playing their lyres. Apparently, in history, the Jews were well known for their music. They were well known for the songs that they sang to God. They were well known for the songs that they sang about Zion and about their nation, about Jerusalem. And in a way, what the captors are doing here, they're saying, come and sing us one of the songs of Zion. Zion was synonymous with Jerusalem at this point. And so what the captors are saying, what these Babylonians are saying to them, is come and sing us one of your national anthems. Sing us one of those songs that you're so well known for. Sing us one of the songs about the indestructible city that you talk about, this city of God. And in a way, they're poking at the Israelites and they're poking at God because they know very well that that city that was called Zion or Jerusalem, it's laying over there in ruins right now. They've completely destroyed it. God has withheld his protection from that city. And now this city of Zion that all of these songs that the Israelites were singing about, that city is destroyed for all intents and purposes from the Babylonians' perspective. And it's interesting, when you see the transition in verse 4, the captors call these the songs of Zion, but you look at the perspective of how the Israelites see these songs. They say, how can we sing the Lord's songs? These aren't just songs about the city. These are songs that belong to the Lord. These are what we use to worship the Lord. These are so integral to our relationship to God. How can we sing these kind of songs in this situation when we're under all this oppression, when our city has been destroyed, when we're displaced from where we need to be? How can we sing these songs and worship our God in pure conscience? How can we get over this feeling of defeat and worship God and sing? But that's the situation, that's the position that the Israelites find themselves in. But then, in verse 5 and 6, as I said before, there's kind of a change in tone. And it's interesting that it starts, this change in tone, it kind of starts with an individual attitude shift. You notice in verses 1 through 4 the pronouns that are being used in verses 1 through 4. It says, "By the waters of Babylon we sat down, and there we hung up our lyres. And how can we sing the Lord's songs?" in verse 4. But then you get to verse 5, and the psalmist takes a personal approach to himself, and he says, "If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its skill, let my tongue stick to the roof of my mouth. If I do not remember you, if I do not set Jerusalem above my highest joy." This personal change in attitude that this psalmist starts with, I think that's key in overcoming this idea of when I don't feel like singing, how do I sing? This psalmist takes it on himself and he says, "I'm going to start with this attitude change." And so he picks it up by starting by saying he needs to remember. He starts off in verse 5 saying, "If I forget Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its skill." And he says, "If I do not remember you," in verse 6. Now that word remember, that idea of remembering the important things, is very key in this psalm. In verse 1 it says, "We remembered Zion." In verse 4, it says, we can't forget, or in verse 5, it says, we can't forget Jerusalem. In verse 5, they need to remember Jerusalem. And in verse 7, it talks about God remembering something as well. The idea of remembering the important things in life and the important things of what life is all about is what's keeping this psalmist kind of going in this situation. I need to remember these important things that have happened so that I can keep on through the difficult times here, so that I can keep on singing and remembering there. And when he says, "If I don't remember, if I fall short in remembering the important things in my life," he invokes a curse on himself. Now that's also unorthodox in the Psalms. A lot of times in some of the imprecatory Psalms and the Psalms where people will curse someone else for their actions, that's the way that it happens. The psalmist will curse another person. But this psalmist is cursing himself. He says, "If I don't remember, let my right hand forget its skill, let my tongue stick to the roof of my mouth." Now, why does he single out those two body parts? Well, if you remember, this psalm is all about singing and praising God in musical worship. They've hung up their lyres. They've decided that they're not going to sing any of the songs. And the psalmist resolves that I need to sing. Even if I don't feel like singing, I need to keep singing and keep praising God. And he says, "If I don't, take my right hand away from me." The right hand was used to play the lyre, to play the harp. And so in a way, the psalmist is saying, "If I stop praising you, don't let me play musical instruments anymore. Take that skill away from me so that I don't have the ability to do that anymore." And he says, "Let my tongue stick to the roof of my mouth." Have you ever tried to stick your tongue to the roof of your mouth and say something? It's almost impossible. Some of you all want to try it right now, but you're not sure if that would be appropriate in this situation. You can go and eat some peanut butter and your tongue is sticking to the roof of your mouth. It's impossible to say anything, let alone to sing something. And the psalmist is saying, "If I forget to remember Jerusalem and forget to remember Zion, God's city where God dwells, and remember God, take away my ability to sing. Don't let me sing ever again." This curse that's invoked on himself is how this psalmist feels. It's how strongly he feels about this idea. He's saying, "Even if I don't feel like singing, that's when I need to sing most. Even if I don't feel like worshiping in the midst of all this suffering, I need to keep on singing. And God, you need to hold me accountable to that. Remind me to do that. Help me remember. And if I forget, curse me, because it would be better for me to keep singing in that area." What we see, I think, here in this transition in the psalm from verses 1 through 4 into verses 5 and 6 is the psalmist shows the difference between feelings and faith. In verses 1 through 4, they're led a lot by their feelings. There's a lot of oppression. There's a lot of suffering. There's a lot of hardship going on. There's a lot of torment that's happening, and they don't feel great. They don't feel like they're in the mood to worship God, to praise God in that situation. But in verses 5 and 6, the psalmist's faith takes over. In that moment, he remembers the things that are important. He remembers there still is a Zion. Babylon says it's been destroyed, that Zion is laying in ruins. But I know God has placed an extreme value on Zion. Zion has this powerful connotation with it. It's never going to go away, and God is all powerful. And I remember that, and I believe in that, and I'm going to keep on singing. And so there's this displacement from faith and feeling. And feeling is not as powerful as faith to this psalmist. But then we get to the difficult part of the psalm. In verses 7 through 9, there's this request to God that's made. And so it starts in verse 7. The psalmist says, "Remember, O Lord, against the Edomites, the day of Jerusalem, how they said, 'Lay it bare, down to its foundations.'" So the psalmist starts in this section by asking God to do something. He asked God to remember. We said that remembering is important in this psalm, and it's not just for the Israelites, but they ask God to also remember something. And he calls two enemies of Israel to the table. He calls Edom and Babylon to the table, and he wants God to remember those two enemies. And he picks those two enemies, I think, for a very particular reason. One of them makes sense, Babylon, because they're being directly attacked by Babylon and oppressed by Babylon. But he brings up Edom first. Edom, you remember, Edom were the descendants of Esau. And so they were the cousins, as it were, to the Israelites. And it's not really clear exactly what happened in the exile, but it seems to be, and there are some verses in the Bible that hint at the Edomites having sort of an alliance with Judah. And they broke that alliance when Babylon came down. And so they decided that they're not going to help the Israelites anymore. And you can read in Obadiah, in the prophet Obadiah, how the Edomites had just total glee that Judah was being destroyed. And you get a picture of that here in this verse. In verse 7, he says, "Remember what Edom did against Jerusalem and what they said." They said, lay it bare, down to its foundations." Or in other words, they're standing by the sidelines watching Judah being destroyed by Babylon, and they're cheering Babylon on. Great, get them. And by the way, make sure you completely destroy them. It's not good enough just to take them into captivity, but wipe them out completely. And they were enjoying that fact. And they shouldn't have been responding in that way. And I think it went a little bit farther than that. If you go and read in Ezekiel 35, we don't have time to do that this morning, but in Ezekiel chapter 35, there's this long prophecy against Mount Seir, which was synonymous with Edom. And what apparently Edom did, they didn't just use it as an opportunity to gloat in Judah's face that they were being destroyed. They used it as an opportunity to kick Judah while they were down. Judah is weak now, and now we can go in too, and we can attack them, and we can plunder them, and we can take things from them. And so the psalmist says, remember what Edom did to us in our exile, and remember that idea. But then he continues that idea with Babylon. In verse 8, he says, "O daughter of Babylon, doomed to be destroyed, blessed shall he be who repays you with what you have done to us." And we'll stop right there. We'll get to verse 9 here in a second. But he says, remember what Babylon did and repay them for what they have done to us. And what we have here is this picture of this eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth mentality, or this principle. But what I think that we forget sometimes, because that's often a negative mentality, a negative principle when we think about it, that principle was actually given in the law, in their law. Look over at Deuteronomy chapter 19. In Deuteronomy 19, starting in verse 15 through the end of the chapter, we have just this judicial system that God had set up for the Israelites, and how they were supposed to use witnesses, how they were supposed to convict criminals, and how the judges were supposed to give this just punishment to the criminals there. And starting in verse 18 in Deuteronomy 19, it says, "The judges shall inquire diligently, and if the witness is a false witness and has accused his brother falsely, then you shall do to him as he has meant to do to his brother. So you shall purge the evil from your midst." This is directly from God saying the just punishment that you can give to a convicted criminal is to do to them what they intended to do to everyone else. And so judges are trying to do that now today, to figure out what a just punishment is for a criminal. How are we going to get a punishment that fits the crime? And God had laid out this principle long before of this eye for an eye, this tooth for a tooth. That's what's required for a person. Now, when people hear eye for an eye or tooth for a tooth, what they interpret that as is this personal vendetta, this personal vengeance. And that's not what this principle is. This idea that if you hit me, I'm going to hit you back. And that's not what God is condoning in the law, and that's not what the psalmist is asking for. You remember, the psalmist is coming from, in Psalm 137, he's coming from a perspective of weakness, of powerlessness. He's not saying, this is what I'm going to do to Babylon. He's asking God to do what God has planned to do, to give Babylon what they deserve, the just, right punishment. Because God had sent Babylon to come and destroy Judah, but they had gone way far above and beyond, and not in a good way above and beyond, of what God had told them to do. And it, the Israelites asking, this psalmist asking for them to repay Babylon with what they had coming to them wasn't really inconsistent with what God had already said he was going to do anyway. When you look at all the prophets in Isaiah, Isaiah prophesied long before the exile. Isaiah prophesied in chapters 14 and 15 about the destruction of Babylon. and how he was going to destroy Babylon and completely take it down to its foundation. And in Jeremiah, he prophesied that Babylon was going to be coming and Babylon was going to take Judah into captivity. But when you get to the end of Jeremiah, Jeremiah also said that God would destroy Babylon, that he would take Babylon out for the evil that they would do. And so what the Israelites are asking here is for a good and just God to do a good and just right thing with an evil nation that was oppressing them. But then we get to verse 9, and this is where it kind of gets difficult for a lot of people. In verse 9, it says, "Blessed shall he be," talking about God, "blessed shall he be who takes your little ones, your children, and dashes them against the rock." Now, there's no way to sugarcoat that. That's not a pretty picture there. But I still don't think that this is inconsistent with what God had already said he was going to do and what the Israelites knew about God. This is what the Babylonians had been doing to the people already. If you flip over to 2 Kings chapter 8. In 2 Kings chapter 8, this is a conversation that Elisha has with Hazael, who was one of the kings of Syria. So it's not a king of Babylon, but this shows that the type of mentality that went into the oppressors that came and took Israel and take Judah into captivity. In 2 Kings 8, in verse 12, Hazael said to Elisha, "Why does my Lord weep?" And Elisha answered, he said, "Because I know the evil that you will do to the people of Israel. You will set on fire their fortresses, and you will kill their young men with the sword, and dash in pieces their little ones, and rip open their pregnant women." Now that is not a pretty picture, but that's what happened when Assyria came in and took Israel. That's what happened when Babylon came in and took Judah. There was no mercy. There was no sparing the little children. Nothing came from Babylon. And hasn't God already said also in his New Testament, judgment will be without mercy to the one who shows no mercy? God still thinks in that way today, still. And so that's what the Israelites are asking for in Psalm 137. But it's also what God had promised would happen to this unbelieving evil nation in Isaiah chapter 14. Isaiah chapter 13, starting in verse 15, this long prophecy against Babylon. The Lord says, "Whoever is found will be thrust through, and whoever is caught will fall by the sword. Their infants will be dashed in pieces before their eyes, and their houses will be plundered, and their wives ravished." And continuing on in chapter 14, and I think that this gives a more clear picture of why specifically the children were zeroed in Psalm 137. Isaiah 14, verse 22, it says, God says, "I will rise up against them," against Babylon, declares the Lord, "and cut off from Babylon name and remnant, descendants and posterity," declares the Lord. There was a reason why the Israelites were asking for the children to specifically be zeroed in on. And now there's difference in culture, but think about it for a second. In ancient times, how were nations established? They were established by dynasties. So a dynasty, one man reigned as king, then his son would reign as king, then his son would reign as king, and they would get more and more powerful and grow in strength and numbers through their lineage. And so it's why when you flip over to Daniel chapter 1, when Babylon came in their initial raid against Judah, it's why Babylon zeroed in on the young men in the royal family. Why did they take Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Why did they take Daniel into captivity, these young men? They were attacking the posterity. They were weakening the country in doing that. And so what Israel is asking, on two parts, they're saying, repay Babylon for what they did to us. They destroyed our children. They tore up our pregnant women. They showed no mercy to us. So repay them with the just punishment that they deserve. But they're also asking them to God to be good and just and to weaken this evil nation that had no regard for God and for mercy and for love and all the characteristics that God is. And so that's still not pretty in Psalm 137. It's still not a pretty picture, but I think it makes a little bit more sense when you put into context what happened to Israel. If you take notes in your Bible, maybe it'd be helpful in Psalm 137, verse 9, to put a cross-reference to Isaiah 14, verse 22. Because I think that makes a lot of sense about why God did what he did and why the Israelites were asking God to do what they were telling him to do in Psalm 137. But that's just a brief exposition of the psalm and what the psalm is talking about. It's a very interesting psalm, but I think there are some really good applications that we can take from this psalm. The first one we talked about, the first thing that I think we need to remember and apply to our lives is that feeling is much different from faith, and it's separate from faith. Sometimes you won't feel fantastic. Sometimes you won't feel great. But that's where your faith needs to take over and carry you through the difficult times in your life, remembering all the things that are important. God is still good in the midst of suffering. God is still all-powerful in the midst of suffering. God is still in control of every situation, regardless of what's happening in your life. And the psalmist resolves in 137 to say, I don't feel like singing, but I'm going to keep on singing. Because I remember and I have faith in Zion and in Jerusalem and in God, who is the king of those cities. And so feeling is different from faith. And then going along with that, the second application to make, I think, is when you don't feel like singing, sing anyway. I think sometimes that's the best thing that you can do. You don't feel like singing, sing anyway. It's amazing how that will change your perspective. I believe that God is worthy of praise even in the midst of suffering. Do you believe that? God is worthy of praise even in the midst of suffering because of who God is. And so, regardless of what happens in our lives, if our lives are terrible and awful, and it gets to the point that the Israelites were at, where they were displaced from their homeland, and they had lost everything, and their women and children were destroyed, and they're at the very low point in their life, this psalmist still realizes God is still God. And I'm still going to sing in praise to Him. So anything that goes on in our lives, are you suffering in your life? Sing. Are you being persecuted? Sing. Are you frustrated with work? Sing. And you'll be amazed at how your perspective can change and put your mind on the good things of God in our lives. And then the last application is when you're powerless in your life, turn it over to God. That's what you see in Psalm 137. These people are completely powerless in their situation. They have no control over it. And while it does seem like from a first glance reading that they're vengeful and that they're going to take vengeance or revenge on the Babylonians, they're not asking that God would allow them to have vengeance on the Babylonians. They're saying, we're in a place of weakness. We're in a place where we don't have power, but we're turning it over to God. And we know that God will do the good and right and just thing. And we trust in a sovereign and holy God, who will always do what's right. And so for us, in a powerless situation, where there's something that's not going well in our lives, what do we need to do? Turn it over to God. If you're suffering from loss of life, a difficult thing, turn it over to God. If you're suffering at work, somebody is oppressing you at work, or you're just having a difficult time at work, turn it over to God. If you're angry with someone, turn it over to God. If you're frustrated or you want revenge on someone, turn it over to God. God has said, vengeance is mine, I will repay. God will take care of all the problems. It's our responsibility to just turn it over to God and trust in Him and have faith in those areas. I think that Psalm 137 is a very fascinating psalm. It's an interesting perspective to come from, of this broken group of people who don't have anything else left but God. And the resolve that's made at the end of Psalm 137 is, while we don't have anything and we don't have anything else to look forward to, we're still going to sing, we're still going to look to God, we're still going to praise Him, even when it gets really difficult. Sometimes our circumstances are out of our control. Sometimes we go into a dark hole, whether that's from loss of life, loss of job, loss of health, loss of friendship, whatever else that we have, and that's hard and difficult to deal with. But while we're suffering immensely in those things, and the last thing that we want to do is sing and be happy, I think this psalm helps us remind ourselves and remember that we have a lot to sing and be happy about, even in those difficult and hard times. Now, this kind of psalm, it only makes sense on one condition. And that condition is that you have decided to give your whole life over to God. This kind of psalm, it doesn't make sense to someone who hasn't given their life over to God. But to the people who have, to the Christians who have, maybe that's the question that we need to ask ourselves daily, and maybe this morning to ask. Have I really given my life, my whole being, everything in my life, my job, my family, all of my cares and concerns, have I given them all over to God? That's the resolve that this psalmist makes, and that's the resolve that Christians need to make today, to give our whole lives over to God. And that's the resolve that people who are not Christians need to make as well. This world is a hard place to live in, and there will be oppression, and there will be difficulties, and there will be torments, and all these different things that happen in the world, but God is strong enough, and God is powerful enough to get everyone through those. And so if this morning you're not a Christian, you need to give your life over to God, you have that opportunity this morning. You can come forward and talk to me about that. And I'd love to open up the Bible with you and we could answer the question together. Where do you stand with God? The Bible is very clear about where you stand with God in your personal life today. And I would love to talk with you about that. Or if you are a Christian and you need the prayers and the help of the congregation here this morning, you can come forward also and talk to me about that now while together we stand and sing this hymn.